This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, my guest is going to be Jeffrey Kripal, who has just recently released a co-authored book with Whitley Strieber called The Supernatural, two words, A New Vision of the Unexplained. And I can say that this book is fantastic. It is exactly what this sort of UFO field needs. It doesn't just encompass the UFO field. And I think that's one of the things that's important about it. It gives us a new way of sorting through the data and looking at its interconnections, as well as a new way of processing reality and consciousness. He uses Whitley Strieber's experiences as a guideline for that. And it's an absolutely fantastic book. So this is going to be a two-part interview. Next week we'll air part two, but it's all pre-recorded. So if you are a patron, you will get the second part right away, so you can listen to the whole thing. After this, I have a lot of interesting people planned coming on in the next couple of months. Some returning guests and some brand new guests. I don't want to say anything because I don't want to jinx anything, but it should be really, really good. All right. Remember to go like us on Facebook. If you want to become a patron, it's only $3 a month, and you get some extra content. And with interviews like this, you get both parts at once. And let's see. There's a forum on the website. I always forget to mention the forum. It's not being used quite as much as I'd like it to. So go talk to us on the forum. If you have any stories you want to share in any respect, whether they be saying we talked about or not, anything unusual that's ever happened to you, I plan on doing a listener story show at some point here in the next few months, but I need some stories from people. So go to the website. You can email me at stories@wheredidtheroadgo.com. There's a link right on the website for it and under the contact section. All right. So, that's it. Here we go. Interview, part one of the interview with Jeffrey Kripal. All right, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Hughes.
Hello, everybody. Tonight.
And Jeffrey Kripal, who is the author of a number of pretty astounding books, the latest being The Supernatural, co-authored with Whitley Strieber. And how you doing tonight, Jeff?
I'm well. I'm tired, but well.
All right. And when did this book come out?
February 2nd.
Okay. And how's your response been overall to it?
You know, the metaphor I always give when I publish a book, it's like throwing a Kleenex off the Grand Canyon. It's nothing. It's like absolutely nothing. And it gets stuck on a limb or a bird gets it, and then it just... it's gone. So that's kind of how this one's been too. It's been frustrating actually. But it's not unusual. That's been my experience with pretty much every book I've written. And then, you know, then you get a letter or you get an email or you meet somebody at an event and it turns out people have read it and it is resonating. So that's just what it's like being an author these days, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can attest to that. I write fiction, horror fiction, and you know, that Kleenex metaphor. I think I might be using that because that really is what it feels like. It just drifts off, and then but it is so rewarding when, you know, every once in a while when someone says, "Yeah, I loved it." You know, that was great.
Yeah. Well, I think this book, it's what the UFO field needs. And it doesn't just, it goes way beyond the UFO field, but it's really what the UFO field needs to get a kick in the ass to kind of look at things differently and move forward with some kind of plan.
Well, you know, that was the intention. The intention of the book, the image that Whitley and I used was, you know, we just wanted to shift the conversation. We didn't want to stop it. We didn't want to, you know, we didn't want to say it's wrong, but we wanted to just kind of shift it in a different direction that might be more productive and certainly a lot more nuanced. Where our sense was is that the conversation is kind of caught in a series of either ors, and we wanted to introduce a both and into the space.
Now, why did you choose the name Supernatural? And it's two words, super and natural.
Well, so this originated actually with a textbook I wrote a few years ago called Comparing Religions, which is essentially a textbook on how to compare religions. And it has a chapter on the very ancient human experience of the sacred or divinity through the natural world. And I coined this expression, the supernatural, three words, to kind of carry this notion that our Western Christian assumption that the divine or the sacred is somehow separate or other or outside the natural world is really just, it's really a function of Western culture. And it's not part of most religious cultures. And so I wanted to capture that notion of the sacred in and as the natural world. And so I coined this phrase, the supernatural. And Whitley and I thought it both worked very well for what we had been trying to say in our own respective work. I mean, a lot of Whitley's work is essentially arguing the same thing, that these sorts of extraordinary experiences are very much a part of the world we live in. They're not outside of it. And so this phrase seemed to work as a kind of mantra for us.
Okay. And you also, you don't really redefine, but you bring back the original meaning of paranormal as well in this.
Right. So yes, so this is where one of the things Whitley and I disagree on in the book is Whitley does not like the language of the paranormal because it's sort of been cannibalized and it refers to things like horror movies today and kind of anti-reason. And what I was trying to do in the book is say, yeah, but if you look at how the word was coined, it was coined by French scientists around 1900, they essentially meant the supernatural, three words again. They were studying things like poltergeist phenomena, and they were arguing that these are not ghosts, these are not angry spirits, these are somehow expressions of living human beings who are in some kind of emotional or sexual conflict, and poltergeist activity is symbolic and it's expressive of living human beings, not angry ghosts. So they were trying to push this same argument that what we think of as paranormal phenomena are actually quite natural. They're just beyond para, our present scientific models of what the natural world is. So it's a kind of naturalizing move in essence. And so I like the language of the paranormal. I think it works just fine if you know what it originally meant. But Whitley's still a little, you know, he's a writer and he's very aware about the nuances of words and what they invoke in contemporary readers. And so he's I think, rightly suspicious of the word.
Well, it's like the word skeptic. I mean, the way it's thrown around today isn't, you know, applicable to its original meaning.
Right. Right. And what, you know, so I, at the end of the day, I'm a professor and I talk about words and I help people think more clearly. And, you know, we're always very interested in why a word was first coined and what it originally meant and how it's changed meanings over the years or decades or centuries. And so this is a case where I think it really does matter. And I think when you understand how the paranormal was coined and what it originally meant. It's extremely useful, but it's not necessarily how it's used today.
Right. What got you interested in this type of stuff?
Well, that's a long story. I'm a historian of religions, which most people would translate as someone who does comparative religion. I was trained to think about religious experiences across cultures and across times and try to figure out what the underlying patterns or mechanisms might be. I never really thought about the paranormal or parapsychology or really any of this stuff until about 10 years ago. I was writing a history of a institute in California called the Esalen Institute. And it's in Big Sur, California. And I was talking to all sorts of people who were involved in that institute or involved in that movement in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And they told me all kinds of stories about things that had happened to them that were certainly impossible by any sort of contemporary scientific or conventional materialist models. But I realized that they were telling me the truth and that these things happened. And I also realized that people like myself in the study of religion didn't talk about them. We had essentially taken them off the table. Mm-hmm. And I found that very curious and really interesting, actually. And I wanted to understand why our ancestors had taken them off the table and how we might put them back on the table again and that how that might change the conversation. So that was about 10 years ago. And I've written, this is really my third book on the topic. The first book I wrote was called Authors of the Impossible. Mm-hmm. And it was really a history, an intellectual history of the paranormal from late 19th century England to contemporary U.S. scene. And then I wrote a book called Mutants and Mystics, which was on science fiction and comic book writers and artists who had paranormal experiences and then turned them into art, essentially. And the last chapter of that book was a study of Whitley Strieber, actually. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know Whitley through that project. And I had proposed to him that we do something together about 2 years ago now. And that's how this book came about. It's through that long circuitous route.
And in this book, you do talk about kind of an awakening experience you have with Shakta Tantra.
Right. So, yeah, everybody always asks me if I've ever had one of these things, and I always hesitate a bit because I'm, as I said in this book, I'm a spectacular genius of non-experience. I'm a complete failure. If you're looking for Mr. Paranormal, I'm not it. But I did have one of these sort of mind-blowing experiences when I was living in Calcutta in 1989. I was working on my dissertation, which was on 19th century Tantra in West Bengal or the Calcutta region. And I had essentially an out-of-body experience while I was sleeping. And so I write about that in this book and to try to explain why I'm so sympathetic to Whitley's experiences. Because I think even though that only happened to me once is enough, essentially, to make one deeply sympathetic to people who describe similar sorts of experiences.
What struck me about your experience is it really sounded like a massive Kundalini awakening.
Well, it was. I mean, that's how. Remember, it's 1989. The language of Kundalini was certainly around. It'd been around since the 60s, mm-hmm. And it's certainly how I understood the event because I was studying Shakta Tantra, which is where Kundalini Yoga comes from, actually. So it made very good sense to me in that context, and I think it was a Kundalini awakening. But you know, it's tied in to the sorts of things that Whitley's experienced in a different cultural context, and so I became really interested in how something could make complete sense if it happens to you in India when you're living in a tantric culture, but the same thing that could happen to you in Nebraska or New York, and it makes no sense,
right?
Because you have no cultural context for it, and so it becomes this terrifying experience that gets coded essentially in very negative ways, where if it happened in India in a cultural context that had some understanding of it, it could be quite positive. And my experience was terrifying, but it was also extremely positive. I would do it again in a heartbeat, or have it done to me again in a heartbeat, even though it's never happened again.
Did you have any after effects from it?
Well, I would argue that all of my books are the after effects of that event. I once thought that the purpose of the event was, you know, to help me reproduce it and to have it again. But clearly that wasn't the point of it, because it's never happened again. but looking back, I realized that all of my work really is an attempt to kind of articulate those sorts of energies and that sort of connection, that deep, deep connection between the spiritual life and human sexuality, which was really what the experience was about on some level. And really, most of my work has been about that question for 25 years now. So I think it deeply informed everything I've done, but not in any kind of direct one-to-one way. I mean, I haven't pursued it as a topic, you know, but I've written about other things and it always seems to come back. So.
Okay. And the sexual component is something that's, you talk about, you and Whitley talk about a lot in this book.
Yeah.
And Whitley opens up a lot about stuff that he'd only kind of hinted at in previous books. A lot of the stuff in this book that Whitley talks about, he talked about in Solving the Communion Enigma, which I know he complained nobody read.
Right. Said that's the Kleenex off the Grand Canyon.
I read it. I thought it was a fantastic.
Yeah, I read it too. It was.
Yeah.
Well, so, and he expands a lot of that in this book and goes much further on and really just kind of opens himself up.
Yeah. You know, and Whitley struggled a bit, in this book to give those sorts of details. I mean, these are intimate things, and someone like Whitley has been, you know, so really shamed for trying to talk about these experiences in any way. And so to add on to that, the sexual dimensions is, you know, in some ways just to invite more shaming and more stupidity, more ignorance.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even say it was shaming as much as it was just brutal mockery.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's just awful the way he was treated.
Yeah, and but what I can tell you as someone who's, you know, studied these things historically and ethnographically with people for 25 years now, whenever someone starts telling me about some kind of extreme religious experience, my first thought is, okay, when are they going to tell me about the sex stuff? And of course, they usually won't early on because they don't trust me or it's too sensitive or whatever. But once you get the first story, then when the second one comes or the third one, and there's a level of trust and there's a level of humanity and just dignity that's created, then usually, you know, here comes the sex. And it's often very bizarre really out of the ordinary. And of course, that's why they didn't include it in the first or second telling. But my conviction is that with a lot of these experiences, not always, but very often, there is a very powerful sexual dimension, and it's integral to these experiences. It's not something tangential. It's not accidental. It's right at the core of things. And as I tried to explain in this book, I don't think we have a clue what human sexuality is. I think we call it sex as if that tells us anything, but it doesn't. Doesn't say any. It's just a marker of our ignorance. It's three letters that mean nothing. So I think it's at the very core of these sorts of things, and I don't think we understand it at all.
No, and you see it throughout the whole abduction phenomena. Whether it be the hybrid children or just the weird, what was the farmer down in South America?
Oh, yeah, Antonio Villas Boas. I mean, that was the first one right out of the bat. There it is.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's to me, it seems like sex is something that is multifaceted that most people don't really think about. That it can have it can do different things to you. It can just be fun, it can be reproductive, or it can be spiritual.
Right, and it's probably all of those all at once, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it's what produces us. It's sure. It's life. It's also, sex is coded with vast amounts of information that we call DNA. I mean, it is really weird. The more you think about it, the weirder it gets. And so, you know, when you have these sorts of experiences, you know, the fact that there's a sexual element never surprises me, because I think it speaks to the multi-dimensions of what we call sexuality, but really is something much bigger than that.
And our culture seems to want to keep spirituality and sexuality on two completely different planes.
Right. I mean, that's part of our – that's true. It's not historically true, I can tell you that. And the fact that people want to keep them so separate, I think, is itself a witness to that they're connected. You know, there's a kind of nervousness there. But if you think about all of the cultural debates that go on in American society around religion – virtually every single one of them has to do with sex.
True.
With the exception of religious violence or terrorism today. But even that probably has a gender or sexual component. Mm-hmm.
So, but it seems like a lot of that is about repressing sex.
Yeah. You mean the terrorism? Or the fundamentalism?
Yeah. You know, whether it be repressing homosexuality or, you know, all the gender blending that's going on or, you know, whatever it is, it's all about repressing.
Yeah. Well, again, I think repression, a lot of religion and a lot of civilization is about repressing sexuality because it's such a powerful force. Yeah. And I think the human consensus is that if we're going to have any kind of civilization, we have to control this thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we try to control it. And it never, of course, quite works, but it sort of works. And I think that's how we, you know, that's where we're at, essentially. And I think what's happening with something like the abduction phenomenon is the sort of metaphysics of it, or the occult nature of human sexuality, just explodes through, and we get these really bizarre stories of discarnate beings, you know, abducting people.
Do you ever get any kind of you have any problems professionally because you look at this stuff?
Oh yeah. Oh my God, yeah. I, you know, my first book was a book called Kali's Child, and it was about a 19th century Hindu saint named Ramakrishna. And it came out in 1995. And by 1997, there were banned movements in India. There were, you know, hate sites on my person and my work. It was eventually debated in Parliament in India.
Wow.
Their equivalent of the CIA has had a file on me. Probably still does.
What were they upset about?
Well, the book took a very honest and very blunt look at the saint's sexuality. I essentially looked at the Bengali texts that recorded his life and teachings, and then I looked at how they were translated into English, and I showed how they left out all of the tantric stuff, or a lot of the tantric stuff. Mm. And much of it was very explicit, and it was very homoerotic. The saint, like many, many male saints in the history of religions, was homoerotic. Attracted to young men, and essentially was relating to divinity as a woman, even though he was physically a man. And that, by the way, is completely traditional, both in India and also in the Christian West. That's totally normal. But of course, for modern eyes, that suggests some kind of homoerotic sexual orientation. And mm-hmm. so that's what the book was about. It was a very appreciative book. I still think the saint is amazing, and I loved the saint. But that kind of open discussion got me in a tremendous amount of trouble.
So that wasn't a Kleenex book.
No, that was the opposite. That was, yeah, no, the, I wish it was a Kleenex book, but no, that was the exact opposite. And no, I still suffer for that book. That was 21 years ago.
Yeah, I saw some of the reviews on Amazon just going crazy about it, and I was like, wow, yeah. All right.
Well, yeah, that's one barometer of the book, but that's the Amazon reviews are nothing compared to what actually happened in the late 90s and early part of the new millennium. I mean, I was essentially chased out of that field.
Hmm. Wow.
And that's, by the way, not unusual in the study of religion. A lot of us are targeted by fundamentalist aspects of the different religions we study. Mm-hmm. And I was just one of, you know, a couple dozen scholars targeted by these groups in the 90s and early part of the millennium.
What about the paranormal stuff? Do you get kind of a backlash now because you're writing about it?
You know, not really. I get asked that a lot. My sense of that is a couple senses. Depends on who you're what audience you're talking about. In the study of in the professional study of religion, which is where I work and make my bread and butter. Everybody knows that I was assaulted for all these years by Hindu fundamentalists for my work on sexuality and mysticism. And so they know that I'm a serious intellectual and that I paid my dues. And I think they sort of give me a free pass, I think, sometimes on this. I think the other thing that happens is when they hear me talk about it or when they read the work, they realize that I'm not suggesting we believe it all literally. I'm trying to forge a different kind of way of thinking about it or talking about it that actually makes a lot of sense to them. Mm. Scholars tend to be very appreciative of it. And they tend to come out of the closet. I give lectures all over the country and in Europe on this material, and inevitably after a lecture, you know, when we go to dinner or something, somebody will pull me aside and say, can I tell you a story? And then I just get one of these crazy ass stories again. You know, just this just was always there in the room, but would have never been told had I not, you know, stood up there and given this lecture on that topic for an hour. So that's really how I see the work is me just being vulnerable in public around these ideas, and then people saying, well, that makes more sense than I thought. So maybe now I can talk about it, or maybe now I can write about it, or teach a class on it. And so, you know, that's how a field grows, actually, is somebody starts to talk about something you're not supposed to talk about. And then more people talk about that person talking about it. And pretty soon there's lots of people talking about it. You know, this is what happened with Freud, talking about something he wasn't supposed to talk about. So I think my experience of the reception of these last three books has been actually very positive. And I think intellectuals are far more interested in these things than most people realize. But they don't necessarily want to talk about it themselves. They're happy I'm doing it. So I think that's part of the reception too. And from where I sit, I mean, I feel like I lost all respectability and essentially died through the Collie's Child affair, which went on for about 15 years. I really can't emphasize how horrible that was and what I lost from it. So I don't feel like I can lose anything else. And I mean, there's nothing else to lose. So I just don't give a crap what people think. I've been through that. I've watched my person and work be completely misrepresented and hated and distorted for, you know, two decades. And so when someone's critical of something I wrote about the paranormal, it's like swatting a flea. It doesn't bother me.
Do you regret writing Collie's Child at this point?
No, I don't. Because it's a great book. It's a beautiful book. And what I said in it is true. I don't think I could ever write it again. So I'm glad I wrote it without knowing, you know, how it would be received or not received. It's the kind of thing, you know, people say, I wouldn't want it any other way, but I would never want to do it again.
Right.
You know, it's that kind of thing.
Well, in the new book, you're kind of trying to lay out ways we can move forward with this material. Not just the whole UFO thing, but all the stuff connected to it, which is really everything. There's no real disconnect here. I mean, everything kind of blends into other stuff, unless you're going to look at it strictly as a extraterrestrial type of thing. When you really look at it, these things connect into different realms of consciousness and other paranormal experiences, and as you said, sexuality and all kinds of other stuff. Let's talk about some of the things and practices you're working with in this book. The first one I think was making the cut, or phenomenology.
Right. So phenomenology is sort of a basic method that we use in the study of religion to study people's religious experiences. And what I mean by making the cut, there's a technical term in the study of religion called the epoche, the bracket. You essentially put a bracket around your own beliefs about what reality is and how it works, so that you can appreciate the religious experience on its own terms, how it appears to that person, how it's described, how it affects the body, how it affects the society in which it takes place. In other words, you you pay very close attention to all the details, but you hold back on drawing conclusions about what's behind it or what's really going on. The metaphor I use in the book, it's like enjoying a good movie. You know, when you go into a theater and the lights go out and the commercials are finally over, you suspend your judgment about what reality is so that you can enter this amazing story up on the screen. And if you don't suspend your judgment, you know, if your wife or your boyfriend or your girlfriend or something sitting next to you saying, well, that's stupid, that can't happen, that's dumb, well, it ruins the movie, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Because they haven't made the cut. They haven't left their beliefs at the door. And so that's just kind of lesson one in the study of religion, is you leave your beliefs at the door and you try to understand what's happened to this person, to this community, on its own terms, and you hold back from making judgments about what's behind it. And that's essentially what Willie does. If you read him carefully, that's what he does over and over and over again. He says, well, this is what I saw. This is how it felt. This is how it affected my family. This is what the neighbor said. But I don't know what's behind it. I'm not claiming what it is. It could be this, it could be that, it could be this, it could be that. So he's actually a kind of intuitive scholar of religion. He's constantly making that cut and making a distinction between what he experiences and what's actually there or not there. So that's what we call making the cut. And of course, this would have this tremendous, tremendous benefits if you just practice it, because what it does is it allows you to take any kind of human experience seriously, however extraordinary or outrageous it might seem. Doesn't matter. You take it on its own terms, and you listen, and you try to understand what happened. And eventually you can remove the bracket. You know, you can ask philosophical questions, but you always are aware that what appears to the person having the experience and what's actually there are likely two very different things.
Right. Okay. And I do think that's something people really need to learn to do with this type of stuff. It's, you know, people so often they have that confirmation bias going on, no matter what they believe, or they try to fit it into what they already think is happening without really looking at the phenomena. And when you look at Whitley's stuff, I mean, he's been misunderstood so many times throughout his career. And then people get upset with him. You know, they think he's, you know, an extraterrestrial proponent, followed by getting upset that he's not.
Right. Right. And if you go back to what impressed me when I first read Communion about a decade ago was how he doesn't really land anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really careful. If you go back and read that book, I mean, the very first line of the book is about the human mind winking back from the dark. I mean, he's essentially suggesting that what happened to him has something to do with mind, you know, not aliens, which really never appear in the book. I mean, he calls them the visitors. I suppose he talks about aliens as well, but he's generally very careful. But, you know, people read what they want to read, and I think that's where a lot of the misunderstandings come from. And Willie himself will say, I think very accurately and very honestly, that, you know, he has got behind different interpretations at different points because he thought that they were reasonable or plausible, and then he's later regretted that. You know, he's struggling, like the rest of us, to make sense of this stuff. And we all adopt, for a time, a particular interpretive framework, and then we let that go and we move on to another and another. And gosh, I wouldn't want my thought or work defined today for something I thought 30 years ago or 40 years ago. I mean that's the definition of an open mind, is a mind that's always changing and always moving forward.
Reassessing your own beliefs.
Yeah. I mean, something I often tell my graduate students is, I mean it as a provocation. It's not really true, but it's worth hearing. I say, you really don't have any business being a scholar of religion until you've lost at least two worlds. And what I mean by that is, if you've never lost a worldview, you're still embedded in the one you were born into. You really have no capacity to step outside a worldview and think about it critically, because you've never been outside your own worldview. You still think it's all true. But if you've just lost your birth culture, you can easily jump into a second culture worldview and think that one's true. But after you've lost two worlds, you start to get suspicious. And you're like, no, wait a minute. Maybe this third world doesn't have all the ice cream either, right? I mean, maybe the whole process of building a world is really what's going on here. And there is no such thing as a correct world or a correct religion or whatever. And I think once a person gets to that stage, they're ready. You know, they're ready to really think about these things seriously. But that's tough. That's a tough message. And I think a lot of people are not ready for it.
And they don't want it.
No. No, they want to believe that the culture they were born into is somehow absolute or universal. When of course, it never is. It's just nonsense. It's just another cultural world.
Okay. How about talking a little bit about historical contextualization when it comes to this stuff?
Right. So that, I think that's the second. So how the book works is we go through, I think there are 18 chapters, or I forget the number. But so I essentially list about 8 or 9 tools that one can use to think about these things. Making the cuts, one of them. Historical contextualization is another. And this comes right out of the toolbox of historians. When historians work with materials, their first move is always to locate a saying or a figure or an experience in its original historical context. So, I'll give you a simple example from biblical criticism. Take the story of the Good Samaritan. Well, to understand that story, you have to locate it in the historical context, and you have to understand that the Jewish communities essentially despised the Samaritans. The Samaritans were, the outcasts of the day. They were the lowest on the totem pole. And so for Jesus to hold up the Samaritan as the hero of the story, it was essentially to hold up a despised minority group as the hero. So that's what we mean by historical context, is you locate something in its original context to understand how it was originally intended and what it might mean. The reason this is so important with the abduction materials, and particularly with Whitley's experiences, is that what the debunkers like to say is that these experiences are anecdotal. And what they mean by that is they mean that they're one-offs. They mean that they have no context. They can't be replicated. They're just statistical blips. And that if you take reality as a kind of statistical smear, these blips all disappear and things flatten out into the kind of normal reality most of us live in. So the notion or the implication of the anecdote is sort of the linchpin of a lot of the debunking literature around paranormal experiences. But it doesn't really work. Because if you look at the history, say, of abductions in the 20th century in the Hudson Valley region, which is where Whitley's took place originally, what you discover almost instantly is that there were actually thousands and thousands of these things that were happening for a century before Whitley's took place. So Whitley's experiences was not anecdotal at all. It fit into a much larger historical context. It actually makes a lot of sense in that larger context. And if then you then place those abduction experiences in Eastern or Central New York in the 20th century, if you place those in the larger context of the history of religions, what you see, of course, is that they're the norm. I mean, essentially what religion is about weird beings from the sky descending and fucking with people, essentially, either literally or metaphorically, and doing things to human beings that boggle human beings. So suddenly the abduction literature doesn't look anecdotal at all. It looks, again, totally consistent with what we know about these phenomena across large tracts of time. So that's what I mean by historical contextualization, is it's really an answer to the debunker's anecdotal mantra.
Okay. Why do you think that there are certain areas like upstate New York and the Hudson Valley area that have more experiences than others?
Well, you know, so historians of religion argue about this a lot. Upstate New York is an area that historians of American religion call the Burned Over District. And it's called the Burned Over District because there was just wave after wave of religious fervor that ran through that part of the country in the 18th and 19th century. And it just created one religious movement after another for centuries. And we don't really understand why. We don't know at the end of the day. And I think the UFO hotspot up there is probably part of that same phenomenon. Now, the simplest answer to that question is simply to say, well, look, that's one of the most densely populated and earliest colonized parts of the country. And so you would expect the most religious revivals and phenomena to take place where there are the most people and people have been there the longest. It sort of works, but it's actually too weird for that to be the case. I mean, when you really look at the history, it's extraordinary how many esoteric or Gnostic or mystical or spiritual movements exploded in that part of the country over those two centuries.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The one people mostly know about, the one movement that originated there that most people know about, of course, is Mormonism.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, that's one of 100. So I don't know the answer to that, but we know historically that there's something about that area of the country that's unusual.
Yeah, because you also had the whole spiritualist movement that started with Fox Sisters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you had...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right up to, you know, fairly current day stuff with Jane Roberts and the Seth material out of Elmira.
The Oneida community was in that part of the country. There were different indigenous or Native American revival movements that were in that part of the country. I mean, it's really extraordinary. So, yeah, we don't know. I mean, I think that's the most honest answer. now, the other thing, though, of course, particularly when you're talking about UFO stuff, I mean, there's so many hot spots, right? I mean, I sometimes wonder if it's just a function of
where the most people are and you have the most eyes on things. I'm skeptical that I'm sometimes skeptical that there are more things going on in a particular part of the country than others. It's just a matter of what's being reported. You know, my colleague Jocelyn Godwin up at Colgate, who blurbed this book, he just wrote a book called Upstate Cauldron.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a wonderful, wonderful history of exactly this. I mean, that's his phrase for the burned over district.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through, you know, probably 25, 30 of these movements.
Yeah, he's on my list of people I'd really like to talk with.
Oh, Jocelyn's wonderful.
He's such a sweet guy, too. I mean, just lovely, lovely yeah. person.
He's sort of the doyen or the dean of this
mm-hmm.
in the American historical sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's only a few hours away from me.
Oh, yeah, good.
Because I'm broadcasting out of Central New York, out of Ithaca.
Oh well, you're in the burned over district.
Yep.
You guys might be burned over yourself. I mean, this could be the whole point of the show.
Well, I'm in Baltimore, which is more, I guess, just burned out maybe than. Burned
yeah, you're in civilized country. Well, listen, I'm in Houston. Let's not go there, okay? Let's just stop before we get into trouble.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the effect that these things have on animals and how that it's one of the things that I think says it's not just in our minds
right.
when we have these experiences. Yeah. What do you think the effect on animals really says about it?
That it's something physical in the environment and that it's not just subjective. I think, you know, there's a lot of discussion of on the electromagnetic effects of these things. I think there's something to that. I don't know what it is, but certainly Whitley talks a lot about the electromagnetic effects of his experiences, his inability to wear watches.
Mm-hmm.
His computers are constantly frying. I've known near-death experiencers who can't wear watches.
Right.
You know, this is not – I think this is an empirical fact whose meaning we just don't know. Again, we just don't understand. And there is some really – there's some early discussions of this. You know, John Keel had a book called The Eighth Tower. I don't know if you guys have read that. It's fairly eccentric. I wouldn't call it reliable either, but it's typical John Keel. It's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
It's just brilliant. And he basically makes this argument that the paranormal is somehow connected to the electromagnetic. And more recently, Lewis Proud wrote a book called Strange Electromagnetic Dimensions,
mm-hmm.
where he sort of updates this thesis. So I suspect that's what animals are picking up on. Of course, they're much more sensitive than humans in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And so they're probably picking up on things we don't even see or detect.
Well, I also find it interesting that Kundalini can give those kinds of effects as well.
Yeah. Well, it's in a very – I mean, if my experience is any measure – I mean, it's an electrical event. I mean, when it happened to me – my first assumption was that I was being electrocuted and that I was essentially dying. So, I mean, it really did involve the neurological system, which of course is an electrical system. So absolutely. But again, we just don't know anything about it because, you know, nobody will study something that they don't think exists. Right?
Fair enough.
Right?
Yeah.
And so to really study this stuff, we would need millions of dollars and generations of intellectuals and scientists and graduate students and institutions and labs and ethical permission and all kinds of stuff for generations. But none of that's ever going to happen until we actually agree that these things are real, because you don't invest institutional time and money into things that don't exist.
And part of the reason that it's so hard to convince people that it's real is that not everyone has these experiences. I mean, you had one that showed you that this stuff exists. There's no way you can deny it after the experience you had. But for someone who's never had an experience, it's so easy for them to just brush it off.
Right. And that's exactly right. And it makes total sense. I get that. And these things are actually not, you can't replicate them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really want them all to go away, the best thing you can do is put them in a laboratory.
And that's, yeah.
That creates all of the conditions to make them disappear.
Oh, you said something fantastic when you were on Rune Soup. What was it? Something about the way this stuff disappears when you put it under in a lab.
Yeah. With Gordon.
Yeah.
That was a fun interview, actually.
The quote just absolutely stunned me, and I'm trying to remember what it was. I know I wrote it down
somewhere. Was it about looking for zebras at the North Pole?
No, it was just it was something like the paranormal is something that happens in life,
right.
Not in a lab or something.
Right. Well, it's true, but see, I think a certain kind of conventional scientist wants to say that if you can't measure something and replicate it and prove it, then for all practical purposes, it doesn't exist. And of course, that's not true. I think more sophisticated scientists know that and will say that. And what's so much fun about studying people's religious experiences, of course, is none of them happen in labs. And they're all spontaneous. And, you know, you never get to them, though, till after the fact. And what you have at the end of the day is a story being told to you by another human being about an event that you were not present for. And so you just have to accept that as part of the condition of trying to understand them.
Mike, do you want to throw – I know you had a lot of questions for him. Did you want to throw something out?
Yeah, sure. I'm primarily interested as a writer of fantastic fiction and dark, spooky stories and things like that. You write a lot, especially in the Mutants and Mystics, about how the literature of the fantastic, it discloses I think you wrote – dimensions of reality that are inaccessible to other intellectual approaches. And I wanted to ask you about that, and also about the, you know, you write about how we were sort of writing our stories and how we look at our experiences, particularly the anomalous experiences we have, as either we're writing them or they're being written. I just find that so fascinating.
Right, so that's actually the argument of Authors of the Impossible, which I wrote before Mutants and Mystics.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. No, that's okay. That's okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, what Mutants and Mystics is an application of that idea to science mm-hmm. fiction and comic book mm-hmm. writers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So the origin of that idea, which is I can count on one or two fingers all the things I believe in the world, but that's one of them. mm-hmm. That there's something truly magical about language, and that we're all caught in these webs of words and grammar from the day we're born to the day we die, and that language is an essence restricting or defining reality for us. Mm-hmm. And so what a real gifted writer can do is use that web of language to get off the web or to take the web down for a few mm-hmm. minutes or a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And my own gut feeling about paranormal experiences is that is essentially what they're about. They're about peeking through this web of words and language that we're caught in. And what's so interesting about them, though, is that they use language to do that. If you listen to a lot of people talk about their paranormal experiences, often they'll literally involve language, like the person will have just written something, or a sentence will appear in a dream, or a billboard will say something that just magically coincides to what they were thinking, or whatever. It's extraordinary how often language is what triggers or really expresses the paranormal event. And so that I found that really, really interesting. The other thing that was really significant for me here is I spend a lot of time at the Esalen Institute and symposia with scientists and philosophers and historians talking about these things. And I listened for countless hours to physicists and neuroscientists talking about the brain and matter and light and all of these wonderful things. But it always struck me that for them, reality is made of numbers at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what science is, that at the end of the day, reality is numbers. Even though nobody can tell you what a number is. and for me, it struck me that if you actually talk to humanists, and by humanists, I don't mean people who don't believe there's a God, but people who work in the humanities, for them, reality is actually made of words and stories. And I just found that to be a really fascinating distinction between a humanist and a scientist. And I think that paranormal experiences have far more to do with story and meaning and words than they do with numbers and measurements and mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to make this argument that, look, if you really want to understand the paranormal, the sciences are great. They can help us. But you're really not going to understand what these events are about until you start asking what they mean and what they intend and what their effect on the person is. Then you can start getting a really good sense of what the paranormal is about. Mm-hmm. And it turns out the paranormal isn't about mechanisms, it's about meaning. Mm-hmm. And that the way meaning is expressed primarily is through language and through words. And so that's kind of, those are sort of the ideas I kept orbiting around with the Authors of the Impossible book. And then what I found with the Mutants and Mystics book, that if you look at the comic book world or you look at the science fiction world, it's extraordinary that some of the most gifted writers are precisely those writers who have had some kind of paranormal opening. Mm-hmm. And they take that event and they turn it into more writing. And so you have some paranormal event around writing and then it produces more writing. And so there's something about writing that I find frankly paranormal. Mm-hmm. Or potentially paranormal. Of course, mm-hmm. a lot of writing isn't paranormal, but mm-hmm. but it can be. That's probably enough.
I was going to say there's a Stephen King's book on writing.
Right.
I don't know if you ever read that, but he's got this great analogy where he talks about the process of writing. He says it's telepathy.
Right.
And he says, here I am. You know, it's 1999. This book will probably reach you in 2002. And I'm sitting here, but we're talking, you know.
Yes.
We're having a conversation across time and space, just me and you. And it, you know, I mean, we take such a profound experience like that, you know, the communicating via written language. And you also talk about, you know, sort of the trance that is part of reading, you know. It's such a unique phenomenon in human behavior, that we're looking at these little squiggles on the paper, but it's creating this you know, thing in our mind. I also thought quite a bit about, you know, I remember when communion first came out, and Whitley was getting a lot of grief from people who were saying, well, he's a horror writer. You know, this stuff has to be, of course he's making this up. He writes horror.
Right. And my response to that is, that's probably why it happened to him. I mean, you know, I would say it's that he writes horror because he was set up as a human being this way by mm-hmm. earlier events in life. And writing horror for him was probably a way of dealing with these experiences or memories or intuitions that then broke out in a very explicit way in the communion events.
Mm-hmm.
So
they were already influencing him throughout his life.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But again, you know, again, the reason I love Whitley's stuff so much is what he would say to you is, well, of course my horror writing influenced my visitor experiences. Of course. Mm-hmm. But there was still something there. And they were using my imagination and my mm-hmm. mind and my life as their material through which they were communicating with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably also why it was so compelling to read, because he was a good writer mm-hmm. to start. He didn't, right. he didn't just say, oh, I need to write a book about this. He was already a writer and a good one.
Right. Well, that's his real, as I say in this book, that's one of his crimes, of course, is that he's just too good a writer. and so, you know, people want to crucify him for that.
Mm.
So the quote, the thing you said on Rune Soup that I found so profound that I had to write it down, and I finally found it, was that strange things happen for a reason in real life.
Right. That's my that's my point about the paranormal having meaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but when you said that, it just struck me so hard as being such a perfect statement.
That's great.
I wanted to ask you, there's an anecdote in Mutants and Mystics that was just so chilling. It's the comic book writer, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Doug
Mench.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that? Because that was a mind blower.
Yeah. So Doug Mench is a very well-known and successful comic book writer, and I invited Doug to a symposium I held once on the paranormal and popular culture, we actually got him on film too. You can see this story recreated on a 14-minute pitch piece on Authors of the Impossible on a website called Jones Cinema Arts. Mm. And basically what happened to Doug, it was in the 70s, he was writing a Planet of the Apes story, and he was writing down this fantasy he was receiving about a large male gorilla named Brutus with a hood over his head and who broke into a human male's home and grabbed his wife by the neck and put a gun to her head. And right after he wrote this scene, he heard his wife calling for him from the other side of the house, and he walked across to see what she needed or what was the matter, and there was a man with a hood over his head, with his arm around her neck, holding a gun to her head. So he somehow, he doesn't know what happened. I mean, part of him thinks he somehow clairvoyantly intuited what was happening, and that could only get into his mind through the fantasy process. Another part of him, I think, was worried that he somehow created the reality by mm-hmm, writing sure. about it. He actually couldn't write for months after this because he was so afraid of what he was writing would happen. Mm. But yeah, that's actually not an uncommon experience among professional writers, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. they write something and then it plays out in the world.
Mm-hmm. My question on that story is, what did he do after, you know, how did he diffuse that situation?
Well, the truth is he didn't. It doesn't end well. No one is killed in the end, but it's a very bad scene. I think I reference the piece in the men's magazine in which he tells the whole story.
Mm.
If you're interested in it,
okay.
But it's not good.
Mm.
Mm. Well, that's unfortunate.
Oh, I had a very minor compared to that, but I wrote a scene that really troubled me about a bunch of children being burned alive. And I went to bed, woke up the next day, and one of the first things I saw on the news was a group of, you know, some crazy, you know, militant religious fanatics or something burned a bunch of children alive. You know, so even though it's not quite as dramatic, it still gave me that feeling, you know, that fear that, you know, oh, you know, even though it's completely irrational, like, did I have something to do with this, you know, by just creating this in my head?
Or that you just picked it up.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, one of the major ideas of these books I've written is that mind is not in the brain. The brain is in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens in a telepathic event or a precognitive event is some piece of information essentially seeps into our brains from this larger mind,
mm-hmm.
which is actually not in space or time. Mm-hmm. And so you could have, you know, we could be picking up things all the time that are happening elsewhere or in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
And then we confuse them with a dream or a fantasy or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't blame yourself.
But
you know, what one of the most interesting parts of parapsychology that I think is the literature on what they call fear of psi.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of boils down to your concern. And the idea is this: if the mind, if the mind actually had some influence over the material world, then why couldn't it be used for negative purposes?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And because most psi is probably going on unconsciously, then not only can it be used negatively, but we could be using this unconsciously, mm-hmm. You know, acting on our aggressive impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you look at what's essentially magic, I mean, mind over matter is just a mm-hmm. fancy modern way of saying magic.
Mm-hmm.
if you look at magical practices throughout the history of human culture, a large portion of them are in fact black magical practices.
Right. Yep.
So there's an understandable kind of reason why we might be afraid of psi,
mm-hmm.
and why we, you know, we do suppress it essentially. So I find that really interesting.
Sure. And there were attempts to militarize it, of course, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that ended on kind of a dark note. Part two will be next week. Again, if you're a patron, you'll have it already. And again, the book from Jeffrey, along with Whitley Strieber, is The Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained. Well worth picking up. And there's a lot more to come in part two. And since we ended on such a dark note, I feel like we should go out on maybe a more humorous note. Months ago, I had, maybe a year ago now, I had Aaron Gullius and Devo Spice on talking about Doctor Who, just as a midweek podcast. And Devo has released a song called Nothing But Truth. And it's kind of a fun look at some of the more extreme conspiracies out there. And so to lighten the mood, Here's Devo's new song, which is also available for download on his Funny Music project. It's thefump.com, thefump.com. And you can get it there for free if you like it, if you enjoy it. I hope it makes you laugh. Here's Devo. See you next week.
Beautiful girls all over the world are really from space. Here they're an alien race. Here this is nothing but truth, baby.
Surprise. Regardless of the truth that is right before your eyes, but alien reptiles run the left wing, and the government's covered up every damn thing. And you may laugh at my tinfoil hat, but I can prove to you that the earth is flat. Just take a good look at the moon, man, and you'll see that it's really nothing but a hologram. There's so much nonsense and all these concepts that people just accept as fact, like the existence of KO, Daily Mail. Can't you see this is all an act to prepare us for the pending alien attack? By conditioning us to serve on Big Mac.
Salty.
Robotic squirrels and reptilian girls were already placed here right in front of the face. Here, this is nothing but truth, baby.
Nothing but truth, babe.
They have been here,
they're here,
for thousands of years.
Long time.
But hey, now don't sweat,
oh,
it. Just keep spending.
Truth. I'm astounded that folks don't uncover stuff. I've been around and I've seen all the cover-ups. I mean, it's not like the government hides it well. Obama's a lizard, you can clearly tell. Now they're breaking down borders, killing reporters, tracking everybody with the chips in their quarters. You are just a pawn in their new world order. Stop. Now think about it.
They're spraying London, they're spraying Paris.
History Channel.
Beautiful girls,
yes.
All over the world,
all over.
Are robots they gave us that are here to enslave us. This is nothing but truth, baby.
Nothing but truth.
Elvis is alive,
oh,
and so's JFK.
You know it.
And they're fighting mummies in their rest home today.
Bubba
Hope.
Nothing but truth. The gates of hell open beneath Denver International Airport. We'll tell you where to go and what restaurants to avoid during your layover. And our special report on Cabbage Patch Dolls. Do they resemble what mutant children will look like after a nuclear holocaust? And are you posting pictures on Facebook for Throwback Thursday? Then you're allowing the NSA to catalog photographs that were taken before Facebook existed. Don't post another picture until you see our special report. Stay tuned to the History Channel, your source for the real truth.